Welcome to Infertility, the Emotional Roller Coaster with Dr. David Palkovitz and Rabbi Aaron Levitt. My name is Malka Sassone. I'm a board member of the Medical Ethics Society and here at Yeshiva University. And let me tell you a little bit about our speakers. Dr. Palkovitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School. And he's also Special Assistant to the President. He's been serving for over two decades as the Director of Psychology at North Shore University Hospital and NYU School of Medicine. Dr. Palkovitz received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania and has published and lectured extensively on a variety of topics related to education, parenting, and child mental health. Rabbi Levitt is here from Boca Raton Synagogue in Florida. He's the assistant rabbi. He graduated from Yeshiva University magna cum laude with a BA in psychology. He received his smicha from Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University and is pursuing a master's in Jewish history at YU's Bernard Revel School of Jewish Studies. He served as the Boca Raton Community Kollel Director of Programming and taught classes throughout the community. Before moving to Boca Raton, Rabbi Levitt taught in Moriah Day School in Englewood, New Jersey, and served as the program director of Camp Moed. So the breakout session is going to be delivered by both of them, and it's going to focus on the psychological effects of infertility that make the psychological effects that infertility may cause for a couple. There's going to be a question and answer session at the end, so if someone has a question or comment, please hold them till the end of the session, and if you're scared you're going to forget them, please write them down. In addition, during the question and answer session, if someone has a question or comment, I will hand you this microphone right here. Although the microphone has no sound, it's being used as a recording device for the session, so everything can later be transferred to an interactive DVD that you may be purchased in subsequent weeks following this conference. So please do not speak unless you're holding the mic. Just raise your hand, and I'll come straight over. And without further ado, Dr. Palkovitz.
Thank you, Malka. Actually, the first speaker is going to be Rabbi Levitt, but before I call on him, I spoke privately to about a third of you or a quarter of you just before the talk. Let me just get a sense. How many therapists, psychotherapists, and future psychotherapists in the room? Okay. How many people are here because of who are more medical, have more medical interests? Okay. And how many people, I was about to do that, I'm sorry. That's me, okay. Okay, and how many people are here because of their own personal experiences and wanting to, okay, fine. Okay, the way we're gonna structure this is I guess informed by Eino Doma Shmi Eloria. There's nothing quite as powerful in understanding something as hearing from somebody who has experienced the processes that we're talking about. Is actually we're going to have the bulk of the time taken by Rabbi Levitt, who has looked at this from all kinds of perspectives. He's going to share some of his personal experiences, some of his pastoral experiences counseling individuals in the Florida area about these kinds of issues. And after he speaks, I'll bounce off him as a discussant. So I want to thank him for coming all the way from Florida, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing his insights and experiences. Thank you.
Maybe I'll stay here.
You want to stay here?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Hello, everybody. I want to thank you all for coming to the session, those of you who are listening to this recording. And it's really an honor for me to be here. I'm very grateful to Rabbi Brander for inviting me to come and speak at this conference. And it's an honor to share this podium with Dr. Palkovitz, who is a tremendous teacher and role model in many, many ways for many, many people. My name is Aaron Levitt. Some of you may know me. I was a student here at Yeshiva University, graduated from Meets, and for the last 4 years, my wife, Elisheva, and I have lived in Boca Raton, Florida. My purpose today is to share a little bit of our experiences in the hopes of perhaps shedding some light on this important issue and some of the emotions that many people deal with when it comes to infertility and in addition to infertility pregnancy loss. There are really different types of infertility, and no two stories are exactly the same. Some people experience primary infertility, which is difficulty getting pregnant in the first place. Other people experience pregnancy loss, where they have either miscarriages, which is a loss of the pregnancy within the first 20 weeks, or stillbirth, which is a loss from 20 weeks and on. Other people give birth to children, and unfortunately the children, lo aleinu, pass away. And everyone's experience is different. There's also something called secondary infertility, which is once you have children, to then have difficulty getting pregnant or carrying a pregnancy later on. So there's all different types of infertility, and of course each one will bring a little bit of a different experience and some different emotions, and no two people, no two couples really react the same way. So all I can offer is my personal reflections on the experience that my wife and I shared, as well as some of the reactions that I've heard from my congregants and friends. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that I have three goals in this session. Number one is I hope that some of the coping strategies that my wife and I used perhaps will resonate with some of the people listening. Secondly, if there's anybody here who has gone through this, which so many couples do, perhaps this will encourage you to speak out about your experiences and to reach out to other people and share with them some of the emotions and feelings that you've had. And if thank God you've not had to experience these types of challenges, then my third goal is perhaps to sensitize people to some of the feelings and experiences and challenges that many, many people go through. Our story is very simple. My wife and I are going to be celebrating our 10th anniversary, please God, this January. My wife is from England. It's a whole story. My family made Aliyah in 1979, lived on a Merkaz Klita, an absorption center, and made very good friends with an English family named the Shaffers. Stayed in touch for many years, even after they subsequently moved back, my parents to Boston and the Shaffers to London. And eventually, on my way back from yeshiva, stayed in London with the Shaffers, you know, in terms of touring and just seeing the country. And at that point, met my future wife. So the beginning of our relationship was great. Our marriage was strong. We lived right here in Washington Heights on 186th Street. And within about a year of being married, we were blessed with a daughter, Shira, and a little cute girl with red hair. And, you know, like a typical young couple, very, very blessed and fortunate and just really optimistic and excited about everything. And graduated YU. My wife and I were both teaching. I was teaching at Moriah Day School in Englewood. My wife was teaching at Yeshiva Noam over in Bergenfield. And we were working in Kemor Shah every summer. And the fifth summer that we were working there, my wife was pregnant. We had spent a year in Gris Kolel in Israel. And we, thank God, got pregnant during that year. And it was a high-risk pregnancy. The reason for that is that my wife and I have a Rh factor. In other words, I have positive blood and my wife has negative blood. And those two don't mix too well together. So that's actually somewhat common. About 85% of people have positive blood and about 15% have negative blood. And sometimes those people get married. So thank God medicine has a way of dealing with that, where there's a shot called Rogam, where in the 28th week of pregnancy, the pregnant woman is given this shot. And once again, right after delivery, and that's supposed to prevent antibodies being created, which will enable future pregnancies. My wife and I did receive that shot both at the 28th week and right after our daughter was born, but unfortunately it didn't work. For whatever reason, we have not figured it out to this day what went wrong, but it didn't work. And then when we became pregnant in Israel, we realized that because of this factor, we had to take precautions. We were seeing high-risk doctors at Mount Sinai. And we came in from camp. We were up in the summer in Camp Marashah. We came in for a routine checkup. And unfortunately, the doctor, you know, had the news that the baby had died. And this was just devastating, as you can imagine. This was at 31 weeks of pregnancy already, which at which point the baby is viable and certainly can be delivered healthy. I literally passed out when the doctor said it because it was just so shocking and upsetting. And at that point, our lives changed forever. And, you know, there are many, many couples who deal with infertility. My wife and I have never had a problem getting pregnant, so I can't really speak to that issue. Our challenge has been carrying through these pregnancies because my wife, unfortunately, did develop these antibodies. The days and weeks ahead were, of course, very traumatic and difficult. In the hospital, you know, you have to still go through a regular delivery, and that, of course, is emotionally and physically challenging in many ways to have to go through all the pains and of labor for a child that didn't make it. And it was a long, difficult delivery. We were in the hospital for about 3 days and over Shabbat. And one of the things that actually gave us tremendous comfort was a book that the social worker at Mount Sinai handed to us called Confronting the Loss of a Baby by Rabbi Yamin Levy. And as a rabbi, I give this book out to my congregants whenever they experience this challenge. It helped me personally so much. Rabbi Yamin Levy, who's a rabbi well known to our community, wrote this book after his own experience where he and his wife lost a child. And it was really the only book that I knew of in English that dealt with this issue of, from a Jewish perspective, how to deal with pregnancy loss. And one of the things that really impacted me tremendously in this book is that Rabbi Levy discusses the fact that in Judaism there's no formal mourning, there's no shiva for any child that dies prior to 30 days of life. And so certainly a stillbirth, there's no formal shiva, there's no mourning customs, there's really no formal way of recognizing or going through the bereavement process. And the couple therefore doesn't know exactly what to do, and the family and friends don't really know how to react either. One of the things that Rabbi Levy talks about in his book is that you do have flexibility, and there are ways to acknowledge the fact that this was a real child, that there was a real connection. You don't have to pretend that it was nothing and sweep it under the rug and move on with your life like some friends and family would like to suggest. But you can actually go through the process of mourning, even if not in the formal halachic sense of shiva, and go through the bereavement process. He encouraged us to give a name to the child, which we did. We called the boy Akiva, and we had a burial. And it was interesting because the rabbi, our community rabbi, advised us not to give a name. He said the custom is to name a boy Adam, to name a girl Chava in this type of case. And while we respect that rabbi tremendously and have a tremendous love for him, we followed Rabbi Levy's advice because it was meaningful to us. We had to, in some way, acknowledge that this was a real child and that, please God, we hope that we will be reunited with that child someday. And so we gave a name that had personal meaning to us. This was very upsetting, very shocking. We didn't really know how to deal with it, but we had to move on with our lives. And school was starting in the next 2 weeks, and somehow we picked up the pieces and kept on going. I'm not really even sure how we did it. But we didn't have a choice. My wife subsequently got pregnant again not long after. And this time the doctors were, of course, very precautious and very aware of the dangers and had us being monitored much more closely. They realized that had they not gone a month in between appointments, they probably would have caught whatever, you know, signals or warning signs there were with enough time to do an emergency delivery. And this time they weren't going to leave so much time between appointments. They were going to check us basically weekly, and it was a much more intense pregnancy, very stressful, as you can imagine. And everything was going fine, but this time, again, even though we were being checked very regularly, out of nowhere, after 16 weeks, once again, we went in for a checkup, and the baby had died. So this, you know, at this point, we were at a loss. We didn't know what to do. To have to bury a second child is just, I can't describe it. I'm sure there are people who can relate to it, but until you experience it, there's no real way to describe what that's like to go and bury a child. This was in March of 2002. And at that point, the doctor said to us, you know, you have a very strong and nasty disease. These antibodies obviously are very strong, and we don't recommend that you try this again until medicine comes up with new technology. They recommended adoption or surrogacy, but to attempt a natural pregnancy again, they did not think would have any hope of succeeding. And so at that point, we actually started to look into the idea of surrogacy. We spoke to Dr. Zalman Levine, who's one of the speakers at today's conference. He's a Frum fertility doctor in New Jersey, also a Musma Chavritz, and together with Rev Willig, who put us in touch with Machon Pua, who's also represented here today. We were looking into the halachic and medical and legal and financial and otherwise aspects of surrogacy. The psak that we received at that time from Machon Pua was that we should look for a single Jewish female to carry a baby for us. You can imagine how simple that is to find a single Jewish woman who would like to carry a child for another couple. And we literally looked for years and didn't find anything. Time passed. We moved down to Boca Raton, joined the community kollel, and at that point, we saw some new experts, and we're in touch actually with some of the leading experts in the field across the nation, and they had some very interesting theories and suggestions that they were willing to try, we were willing to try, involved very intensive pregnancy, including intrauterine blood transfusions. Literally, in other words, that this baby, in order to create, to avoid these antibodies attacking the baby's blood, we would literally go in utero, take out the baby's blood, and put in positive blood in utero, and just try and basically get the baby healthy enough till we could deliver a viable fetus. We did get pregnant, once again, thank God, and had to drive down to Miami very often for these extremely intensive and expensive and stressful medical procedures. At this point, my daughter, Shira, was now about 5 years old, and she was too young really to know the first two times what had happened. Perhaps she sensed our stress or our emotions, but I don't think she really understood. We never really explained to her, told her anything. But now she understood that mom, Ima and Abba are pregnant, and we have to go see the doctors, and she understood that there was a lot involved. Unfortunately, this pregnancy, once again, did not yield the result that we had hoped, and we had gone through several of these intrauterine blood transfusions, but once again went in for another checkup and were told that the baby had died. So this was just devastating, because now we had waited basically 3 or 4 years since the last time. We had been looking for a surrogate all this time. We finally had a new medical path that we thought would work, and we had tried, you know, very difficult and challenging approaches, and it didn't work. And we knew somehow, you know, sometimes in life you just know deep down. We knew it was going to be a girl. We knew we were going to call this girl Rina, because the pasuk that we say in the introduction to Birkat HaMazon was so meaningful to us, where we say Hazorim Bedima Berina Yiksoru, that when you plant with tears, you will reap with Rina, with joyous song. And we just knew that this was going to be our Rina, and it was a girl. And I flew up with her to New Jersey, because I wanted to bury her together with her siblings, her two siblings who didn't make it. We decided not to name her Rina, because we wanted to have faith that one day we would, please God, have a successful delivery and pregnancy, and we called this girl Amuna because of that. At the time, my daughter, now 5 years old, had tons of questions, because she knew we were pregnant. She was hoping and praying and looking forward, you know, to having a sibling and so on. And so we had to tell her, we had to explain to her, and she was actually amazing. She wanted to know a lot of factual questions. What happens to the baby? What do you do with it? You know, are you going to be okay? She had lots of questions, and we answered her very matter-of-fact, and she really responded beautifully. We showered her with love and attention and didn't dwell on the sadness in front of her, so that she wouldn't take it too hard. And we, you know, you still have to be parents to the child that you do have, which also helped us really cope with it, because despite all these tremendously painful experiences, we still had, thank God, a wonderful child who we could shower our love on. One of the sections of the Torah that had been most meaningful to us was Parshat Ve'etchanan, in which Moshe Rabbeinu asks God and begs God for permission to enter the land of Israel. And God says, no, you can't enter the land for whatever reasons. And Moshe begs and pleads, and God says, no, I'll tell you what, you can look, you can climb the mountain and you can look, but the answer is no. And that was always so meaningful to us, because the idea that sometimes, you know, we think God doesn't hear our prayers and we start to question our faith, and yet we see from Moshe Rabbeinu that sometimes God hears, but for whatever reasons, even if we don't understand it right now, the answer is no. And even Moshe Rabbeinu can still have faith. There was a fundraiser for Tzedakah that was writing a Sefer Torah. We purchased Parshat Ve'etchanan because it was so meaningful to us. And then, of course, after this pregnancy loss, the third one, once again, we were devastated. And at the funeral, which consisted of the rabbi, my parents, and my brother, along with myself, I spoke and I talked about this Parsha of Ve'etchanan. And we recited two Mizmorim of Tehillim that I thought were personally meaningful, because once again I wanted to make it personal and have it speak to me. And we recited Shir HaMalo, the same Shir HaMalo from before Birkat HaMazon, and we recited those words of Hazorim, Bedima, Berina, Yiksoru, to remind ourselves that even though right now we're planting, we're burying, please God, there will be a flowering in the future. And we recited the Mizmor that we recite at the beginning of Pesukei Dezimra, Mizmor Shir, and specifically the end of that Mizmor, where we say, Hafachta mispedi l'macholi, you have turned my hesped, my eulogy, into dancing. Pitachta saki v'tazreni simcha, you have opened my sack and given me simcha, and given me joy. And in that Mizmor, it also talks about Va'etchanan El Hashem, that we pleaded and begged God. And somehow, you know, again, these things just come to you. The night before the funeral, just couldn't sleep, and I somehow started writing notes down, and I figured out that Va'etchanan equals Shira in Gematria. And it was so comforting to think about how our Shira, thank God, was such a comfort to us, that she helped us, you know, deal with this difficult, painful loss. By the way, one other point about this third pregnancy loss. The first time we had lost Akiva, the nurse in the hospital, the social worker, offered us if we wanted to hold the baby, if we wanted to have a bit of the hair to keep, you know, pictures, footprints, all kinds of things, and it was just too much. We just were in such shock, we couldn't do it. And then we felt guilty afterwards for not, you know. This time around, my wife held the baby. I wasn't able to emotionally. I couldn't do it, but my wife held the baby, which was very difficult, of course, but she's so grateful that she did. It was such a meaningful thing for her to hold that child in her arms, even though, unfortunately, the child was not alive. So this was like our story of three pregnancy losses, and we had many, many friends who had gone through either primary infertility or through pregnancy loss, and in that sense, we were able to find comfort in them and try to comfort them as well. But at this point, it's just a devastating kind of feeling when you realize that, thank God, we have Shira 1,000 times, but not only how much we've lost in the past, but in the future, there's just no hope. There's just nothing we've tried has worked. Let me take a break for a moment and talk about some of the emotions that we went through. Some of them might be common to other people's experiences. And like I said, everyone's experience is different, so some of them might be unique. I don't know. First of all, in terms of our own emotions, they ran the gamut. We felt shock, just utter shock that such a thing could happen, especially the first time when we were not anticipating it whatsoever. Denial, you know, you can't believe that you're in this situation. You ask yourself, why me? What did I do wrong? You know, obviously you feel a tremendous sadness, and you start to question what meaning life has, what the point of it all is. You feel angry at God even. You know, here I am trying to be a good person, trying to be a good Jew, to do mitzvot, and, you know, why do I deserve this? Fear of, you know, just never being able to fulfill our dreams or having other bad things happen to us. We actually felt guilt. Physical guilt, my wife felt, maybe it was her fault, maybe she did something wrong, maybe she wasn't careful with the pregnancy, and I personally felt like a kind of a spiritual guilt, maybe I did something wrong, did I deserve this punishment? Maybe I'm not worthy, maybe this is my own ish. Embarrassment, you know, all our friends all around us, especially living in the Heights or then living in Boca Raton, everyone's having babies, thank God. And it's embarrassing. It's a little bit embarrassing that, you know, what's wrong with us? Why can't we be like everybody else? Just an emptiness. For me personally, my name is Aaron, so I always, the pasuk Vayidom Aharon, Aaron's reaction when he loses his two children, that he's just silent. There's nothing to say. There's no words. You don't know how to even approach it. And just like a hopelessness and a purposelessness, the pasuk talks about Rachel when she is infertile, and many of the imahot, many of our mothers were barren, Sarah, and Rivka and Rachel and Chana, many of them were barren. So the pasuk about Rachel in chapter 30 of Reshit says, "Vateru Rachel ki lo yaldala Yaakov." Rachel sees that she was not able to give birth like her sister Leah for Yaakov. "Vatikanei Rachel ba'achota," and she was jealous of her sister. "Vatomer el Yaakov," and she says to her husband Yaakov, "Hava li banim, give me children. V'im ayin meita anochi," and if not, it's as if I'm dead, right? It's as if I'm dead. And actually, it's interesting. We'll talk in a few minutes. Yaakov's reaction. Vayichar af Yaakov b'Rachel. Yaakov gets very angry at Rachel. Vayomer hatachat Elohim anochi. He says, "Am I instead of God? Am I in God's place? Asher mana mimech pribatan, who has kept children from you? Is it my fault? Do I have the ability to solve this problem?" And he gets angry at her, which we'll talk about his reaction a little bit later. But the sense of im ayin mita anochi, that Rachel felt just a hopelessness. What purpose does my life have? If I can't have children, it's as if I'm dead. And Rashi right there makes the comment, mikan lemisha ein lo banim shechashuv kemet. You see from here that somebody who does not have children, it's as if they are dead. Somehow they're not fully able to actualize their life, to give meaning to it, and there's a part of them that's dead, and that's how we felt. That was in terms of our own emotions. But what was interesting also, I don't know if we realized it at the time, maybe now some time has passed and we've been able to reflect a little bit, some of the emotions of other people, which is also an interesting topic. People have no idea what to do or what to say when a friend or relative of theirs loses, you know, can't get pregnant or loses a child. It started with a doctor. This unbelievable doctor with the greatest reputation lost every shred of respect that I had for him when he came in to the room after he heard about the loss, and my wife was waiting to deliver this stillborn, and he said to them, "I want you to know, it's not our fault. There's nothing we could have done differently. I feel confident that we did everything we could." Now, you know, that may be true. This is not the time. I mean, I wasn't thinking about lawsuits at the moment. He didn't have to cover his tracks. What he should have done if he wanted to say anything was say, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." Maybe if he wanted to say, "There's nothing you could have done differently." But he was basically covering up his own guilt or his own feelings. The rabbi who came to see us, again, meant so well, but sometimes you just say the wrong things. He tried to give us all kinds of answers about emuna, how to strengthen our faith, and why God may do this, and even though we may not understand, you still have to believe. And again, maybe later that would have been appropriate, but at the time we just weren't ready or interested. We weren't ready for the answers. All we were able to do, even in barely that, was just to experience what we were going through at the time, just to feel those emotions. It wasn't time to intellectually process or spiritually process what was going on. And of course, you have all the family who they want to be of comfort to you and help you in any way, but they're going through their own pain. Grandparents have just lost a grandchild. They've lost their future. Uncles and aunts and so on are feeling their own loss as well. And certainly when it comes to friends, friends have no idea how to react. And at first, this really upset us. It was really painful to us. Some friends would try to minimize our pain. They'd come over. They'd also try to give us answers or to say, "You have no idea that God blessed you with these holy neshamot, that only parents like you could raise such a pure neshama that was so holy that it had to go right back to God." And it was comforting in the sense to think about that, but it just, again, it wasn't the time. And we weren't ready to hear it. Some people made very insensitive remarks, obviously unintentionally. One of the rabbis in the community, the third time, called up. I picked up the phone, which I hadn't been doing very much because I wasn't really ready to talk. But for some reason, I picked up the phone, and he got on and he said, "How is your wife doing?" Which to me was so painful because that's a good question, but how am I doing? You know, you're talking to me right now. I'm also going through a lot of pain. And he didn't acknowledge that at all. We have a friend who came over during Yom Tov, shortly thereafter. This was shortly before Pesach. So over Pesach, a friend came over, and somehow, I guess we were taking out the garbage, and maybe my wife made some comment about how it was going to be difficult over Yom Tov. It was a long Yom Tov, and the garbage pickup wasn't until much later, and we had all these, you know, the garbage from the holiday. So the friend commented, "I don't know what's the problem. It's not like you have diapers." Which, you know, when you hear that, it bites at you. They had no idea what they were saying. If they thought about it afterwards, they probably would have felt so embarrassed and guilty. But these things come out. As the rabbi of the shul on Yom Kippur, it was after Kol Nidre night, and I was just sitting there reflecting for a few minutes, and one of my congregants, a young individual, came over, and he looked troubled. I said, "What's the matter? You want to sit down and talk?" So he was just all stressed and tired, and I said, what's happening? He said, "I can't take it anymore. The baby keeps me up at night and is crying, and it's just, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't take it." And I wanted to strangle him, you know, because you know how much I would give for that problem? Don't complain ever about a baby crying and keeping you up at night. And people don't realize, they just make these insensitive comments because they're only thinking about themselves. But, you know, we felt at the time that as insensitive and hurtful as some of those comments were, at least some of those people were trying to say something. They were trying to find the words to do whatever they could to help us, to alleviate our pain, to be there for us, to show that they cared. What was much more hurtful to us personally, I don't know if this is the same for other couples that experience this, is the friends who didn't say anything, who stayed away. And now, again, reflecting back, I could understand they were just so hurt and so shocked and so scared, and maybe they had no idea what to say. You know, we all feel sometimes uncomfortable making even a shiva call, because what are you going to say? And you think you have to have all the answers, and really the secret to a shiva call is not to say anything, just to sit there. Even the halakha says you don't speak when you walk into a shiva home. You just sit down and you wait for the mourner to speak, because it's not about giving answers. It's about just being there and showing that you care. And our friends who stayed away was the most hurtful of all, because it made us feel like they had no care. They didn't appreciate the pain we were going through, and that was the most difficult thing of all. So at least, even though sometimes people say the wrong thing, at least they had the courage to say something. The most comforting thing that some of my friends did, and I think for my wife as well, was not words, but actually just hugs. I went back to shul. The burial that third time was on a Friday. I flew up, buried in New Jersey, flew right back to Florida the same day. Didn't go to shul that Friday night because it was just too hard. But then Shabbat morning, I went to shul, sat in the back, you know, walked in a little bit late, left a little bit early. Wasn't in the mood to talk to anybody. But two of my friends came over from behind and kind of wrapped their arms around me, just kind of hugged me for about 30 seconds, which guys don't do, you know. But that was like the most comforting thing of all, because there were no words, and they didn't need to say any words, and they realized themselves that there's nothing they can say, but that said it all, which was very comforting. The one last thing about the emotions of it, it never ends. In other words, you don't get over it. It's true that time tends to heal wounds, but you never get over a pregnancy loss. And certainly, again, I can't speak to the case of people who are having trouble getting pregnant in the first place, but that obviously doesn't go away until the problem is solved. We would attend other people's brises, close friends of ours for whom we were so happy and joyous, it's like really happy for them, and yet it would be so painful, you know, and sometimes we'd have to walk out in the middle because it was just reminding us of our own loss. We had friends who lost a child in the 9th month, and the same day that they lost their child, unexpectedly, good friends of theirs gave birth to a child in the same hospital. And they tell me that to this day, every time they see that child, it just brings back, this is what our child would look like if he were alive today. And he was also a boy. And it never goes away, you know. And for us, what I said to Elisheva and to my friends at the time was, you have to understand, we're not just mourning the past. We're not just mourning what could have been with these 1, 2, 3 children. We're mourning the future, because this isn't just a fluke thing which the doctors didn't understand and hopefully next time it'll work out. The doctors knew there was a problem, said there's basically no hope. So we were really mourning the future as well. And thank God we had Shira, but it was just sort of like a double kind of mourning for the past as well as for the future. I'd like to take my last couple of minutes and share with you some of the coping strategies that we used to help us through these difficult times. Once again, I know I keep saying this, but everybody has different approaches. What I'm going to share with you worked for us. It may not work for other people, but if you're going through it yourself, or if you've gone through it yourself, maybe it'll speak to you, or maybe you have something you'll add at the end that worked for you. And if you know somebody who's gone through this, maybe some of these ideas will help you relate to them. I'll tell you the truth. At first, the immediate coping strategy for us was just to distract ourselves, just try not to think about it. To try to think about other things, because it's impossible not to think about it. That's all you're thinking about. So like, it sounds terrible not to think about it, but what it basically means is to try not to think about it all the time, just to take breaks here and there, watch a TV show, go out to a friend's house, go for a walk, just try to get your mind off it. That was our immediate coping strategy, but it didn't work. It didn't really work because, first of all, it would just make us feel guilty. How can I be laughing at that funny line on the TV show when I just lost a baby? You know, what's more important here? And we'd like laugh and then we'd feel so bad and we'd like, it would make it even worse. Like we'd feel so sad afterwards because we just had fun for 5 minutes. How could we be having fun at a time like this, you know? And it wasn't really dealing with our pain, it was just avoiding it. It was just kind of, let's not think about it. So it may have helped in the short term, but it wasn't a long-term strategy for us. We found three strategies that worked for us. I don't think we planned it this way. It just kind of, this is, in reflecting back, I think what we did. Number one is we tried to find other meaning in our lives besides having children. If we weren't able to have children, then it didn't have to be that our lives had no meaning. Friends of ours, after the second loss, took us to a tree planting ceremony for bereaved couples who had gone through stillbirth. And we thought it was kind of silly, whatever, you know, we're going to go plant a tree. But I'll tell you the truth, it was so powerful. We went to one of these things and we saw, first of all, that there were other couples there. And we weren't the only people in the world to be going through this challenge, which is so comforting to know. I mean, it didn't lessen our pain, but at least it made us feel that we're not the only people going through this. And if they can get through it, we can too. And planting that tree in the ground, which is kind of meaningless, was so symbolic for us because it said we have to plant other roots. We have to be productive in other ways. We have to contribute to the world in other ways, you know, besides definitely raising our daughter and giving her all the love, thank God, that we can give. But we have to find other ways of being, of finding meaning in our lives. When Yaakov gets angry at Rachel, there's different explanations about what exactly he's angry about. Some say that Yaakov is feeling helpless and he's feeling guilty. And he's feeling like a husband who feels so terrible that he can't give his wife, which he so desperately wants more than anything else in the world, you know. And that's how he just sort of instinctively reacts, even though kind of getting angry and yelling at her probably isn't the right solution, but it's kind of reflective of his own pain. I'll show you another example of that shortly. But another understanding of why Yaakov is angry at Rachel is because he's saying to her, Rachel, don't give up and say, "Im ayin mita anochi," that if I can't have children, my life has no meaning, it's as if I'm dead. You have to find other meaning in your life. This can't be the only way that your life has any meaning, and if you can't have children, you might as well be dead. Even though this is tremendously painful and challenging, you're going to have to find some other way of contributing and helping other people for your life to have meaning. So there's different ways you can find meaning in your life. One way is to do chesed and to do mitzvot and to help other people. We just read Parshat Noach yesterday. Eila told that Noach ish tzadik. So Rashi makes the comment on that pasuk. These are the offspring of Noach. Noach was a tzadik. So what does that have to do with offspring? So Rashi makes the comment, Lamad sheikar toldotehem shel tzadikim ma'asim tovim. This teaches that the ultimate offspring of righteous people is not their children, but their ma'asim tovim, their good deeds. That you can find meaning and feel like you're producing and contributing to the world, not only through your children, but through doing good deeds, doing ma'asim tovim, which we try very much to do. The pasuk that we recite in Shema, v'shinantam levanacha, you shall teach your children, right? That could be a very painful pasuk to recite twice a day for a couple going through infertility. But Rashi there also makes the comment, you shall teach your children, elu hatalmidim. This refers to students, not to biological children necessarily, but to students that you can teach. You can be a role model. You can be an example to people. And that too can be a way of producing and of giving over and finding meaning in your life. So for us personally, we try to find meaning in our life by helping other people who go through this. And so many couples go through this. It's almost like a stigma, especially in the Frum community. People don't want to talk about it too much. But we do. We talk about it all the time. And people call us all the time because they know that we're open about it. And it helps us get out our own emotions, but it's so meaningful to us to be able to kind of walk other people through it, even though everyone's experience is different. But we feel like if we can reach out to other couples going through this, that makes it more meaningful to us. My wife started a support group for women in the community, and it was such a powerful thing because they needed an outlet to talk about the emotions that they were experiencing that maybe they couldn't necessarily discuss with their friends who were getting pregnant every day, or maybe even sometimes their husbands couldn't fully understand it, and the women needed an opportunity to talk amongst themselves. The truth is, men need an opportunity to talk about these things too, and men are sometimes a lot more hesitant to open up and to talk about their emotions. And while we never started like a formal support group for men in our community, as individuals, I found a lot of bonding connections and relationships with other men in the community who had gone through similar experiences, and we were able to talk it out, which was very, very helpful. And we're hopefully writing a book, my wife and I together, about all these experiences in the hope, once again, of sharing our experiences and feelings and hopefully helping other couples. And that's a way of us finding meaning in our life besides having biological children. A second approach is, a second coping strategy is the idea of trying to build a stronger marriage. I told you before that when Yaakov yells at Rachel, it's sort of perhaps reflective of his own pain and how much he wants to give to his wife. And yet he yells at her, and the Midrash criticizes him for doing so. Sometimes a challenge like this can tear a couple apart. And we see the same exact thing in the book of Shmuel Aleph, chapter 1, when we find the birth of Shmuel. Chana is infertile, and her husband Elkanah says perhaps the most insensitive line in Tanakh. He says to her, Vayomer la Elkanah isha. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Chana, lama tivki? Why are you crying? I understand why you're crying. Velama lo tochli? Why aren't you eating? Velama yireh levavich? Why is your heart so sad? Halo anochi tov lach mi'asara banim? Aren't I better for you than 10 children? What a stupid line, you know what I mean? Aren't I better than 10 children? With all due respect, honey, no, you know? All right? What is he thinking? I mean, and I'm sure there's ways we could defend and explain Elkanah, and now's not the time, but a challenge like this can tear couples apart. They can blame each other, or at the very least, they can grow distant from each other. And I've seen that, unfortunately, happen sometimes. So many marriages are strained, you know, for different reasons, some for financial reasons, some for all kinds of reasons. But one of the main challenges that marriages often face is this concept, this area of fertility. We knew that these experiences would either tear us apart or bring us much closer together. We just sort of instinctively sensed that. And it wasn't that we were blaming each other and thinking, well, you're the one who has the problem. No, you're the one who has the problem. Actually, it was both of our problems. One had negative blood, one had positive blood. So no one could blame anybody or point fingers at anybody else, you know. What the problem was that it was just, it's hard to be there for someone else's pain when you're going through your own pain. How can I embrace you and be there to catch you when you're falling, when I'm falling too? And I have so much of my own pain at the same time. And even from the first moment, you know, you go through delivering a stillborn. You can't hug. Your wife's a nida. You can't even reach out and hold a hand at that time, the most difficult, painful time. It's such a difficult thing. But we knew right then and there that we were going to have to connect emotionally in order to be a support for each other. And I'm just so thankful to God that I'm blessed with a wife who was able to, you know, be there for me, and hopefully I try my best to be there for her. And that's a tremendous coping strategy, that if you're blessed enough, any kind of challenge in life, to have a partner who will be there for you while experiencing their own pain, that can be a tremendous source of nechama and of comfort. And the third coping strategy for us personally was prayer, was tefillah. I mentioned before the story of Moshe Rabbeinu praying to God to enter Eretz Yisrael. The Midrash on that story comments that you learn from Moshe never to give up when you daven. The language of Chazal is, even if the sword is on your neck, you never give up. Moshe Rabbeinu, God had told him no, 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 and he keeps asking. And even though ultimately the answer was no, he did, first of all, achieve something. God let him go up on the mountain and take a look. And you see that you should never give up. And we felt very much instinctively that we should never give up on our hopes and our prayers to have children, despite what the doctors were saying and despite our history. The Gemara in Yevamot, it's a very challenging, thought-provoking Gemara, but the Gemara asks, why were so many of our Avot and Imahot barren? Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Chana, so many of them were barren. Why is that? And the Gemara says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitaveh letfilatan shel tzadikim, because God wants to hear our prayers, which is a very challenging statement, which, you know, you can think about what exactly that means. It can mean different things to different people. But we understood very much that it wasn't that God didn't like us or he was abandoning us or wasn't interested in us. It's the opposite. He wanted to hear from us more, and we had to dive into him. And we felt like God wasn't giving up on us, so we shouldn't give up on us either. The pasuk lahagid baboker chazdecha ve'emunatcha balelot was meaningful to us. Lahagid baboker chazdecha, we recite your chesed, your kindness in the morning, ve'emunatcha, and your faith balelot in the night. So the traditional way of understanding that is in the morning, the daylight, when everything's clear and you understand everything, why everything's happening in your life, so we can clearly see God's chesed. But in the night, during those dark, challenging times, when you don't understand why things are happening, you have to have emunah, you have to have faith. But Rav Shlomo Karlbach, I once read, quoted in the name of Alexander Rebbe, that it doesn't say ve'emunateinu balelot, our faith at night, that we'll talk about our faith. It says emunatcha, we'll talk about your faith. That what gets us through the night, through the difficult times, is not our having faith in God, but it's remembering that God has faith in us and that he still believes in us. We would sometimes question, you know, is there ever going to be a solution? And we would be reminded of the pasuk that we recite in Ashrei, Einei kol eilecha yisaberu, v'ata noten lahem et achlam bi'ito, that all the eyes look to you, God, but you give to them their what they need, bi'ito, in the right time. Maybe it's not happening right now. Maybe this is not the right time. Please, God, it'll be b'sha'at tova. It'll be literally b'sha'at tova, at the right time. And we had a friend who also comforted us by reciting to us the line from Baruch Shamar, Baruch gozer u'mekayim. Baruch gozer mekayim. Blessed is God who's gozer. Sometimes he decrees harsh things, but he's mekayim. He supports you. He's there to catch you, even during those difficult times. And that was meaningful for us. And not only praying for ourselves, but praying for other people. Rashi makes the comment on the pasuk v'Hashem pakad et Sarah, that God remembered Sarah and he blessed her with a son, which is the Torah reading on Rosh Hashanah morning. It's such a significant time when we talk about these ideas of infertility. So v'Hashem pakad et Sarah, Rashi tells us, why does this passage of Sarah being remembered follow right after the story of Avimelech? L'lamedcha, to teach you, shekol ha-mevakesh rachamim al-chaveiro, that anybody who prays for his friend, v'hu tzarich la'oto davar, and he himself needs that same thing that he's davening for his friend, hu ne'enet chila, he will be answered first. I developed the custom at some point that every single brit milah that I went to, and I went to many, many as a rabbi, especially in a young community like Boca, that I would recite the 15 Shir HaMalo paragraphs. There's the idea that during a brit milah, and especially auspicious time when the baby is crying, to daven for your own needs and for other people. And I would recite the 15 paragraphs of Shir HaMalot during every brit milah. And of course I would daven for myself, for my wife, but I also look around the community and think of all the people who were trying so hard to become pregnant, and I would daven for them. And that was very meaningful to us, to be able to pray for other people. The story has a happy ending, thank God, which I saved for the end. We had been looking for 4 years for a surrogate, to the point where we couldn't find a single Jewish female. We even had a family member who offered to do it for us, but the poskim said it was too close, and we shouldn't do that. Finally, the poskim told us, you've been looking for long enough, we'll allow you to use a non-Jewish woman, and there are different views about that. We'll allow you to use a non-Jewish woman and convert the baby. But right before we were literally going to go follow that route, this is now Pesach, a year and a half ago, our lawyer called us right before Pesach and said, I've got good news for you. I found a single Jewish woman right here in Florida, which happens to be one of the best states legally for surrogacy. And she's right here in Fort Lauderdale, and she is willing, she's done this before for another couple, and she is willing to carry your baby. So this was unbelievable. We went ahead and raised the money, did the contract, did the IVF, did everything we needed to do, got all the halachic things organized, and found out Parshat Noach, of all parshiot, literally a year ago this week, that she was pregnant. And we felt that was meaningful because Parshat Noach, many people use the teva and the 9 months in the boat as a symbolism for the womb and for pregnancy. And then found out several weeks later, Parsha Toldot, the Parsha of the twins, of Yitzchak and Rivka giving birth to twins, found out that it was indeed twins that she was pregnant with. And 4 months ago yesterday, we were blessed with a boy and a girl, twin, Simcha and Rina, which we named because that was our Rina that we had waited for all that time, and that was our Simcha, the Tazrini Simcha that we had waited for. They were born on June 13th, 613, which we thought was cool. And, also, I don't know how I noticed this, one of those things, again, where you're like up at night and these things come into your head. Rina was born at 2:16 in the afternoon, and Simcha was born 2 minutes later at 2:18 in the afternoon. Somehow I got into my head that if you add those two numbers together, it equals 434, which in Gematria is Teled, that she will give birth, which is cool. And then I found the pasuk in Mishlei in Proverbs, which says, which maybe, I don't know if it makes sense, unless you're going through something like surrogacy. Now it makes sense to me. The pasuk says, Yismach avicha v'imecha, your father and your mother will be happy, v'tagel yoladetecha, and the woman who gives birth to you will be joyous. Which we never understood before, but now we understood. That sometimes you could have your father and your mother, and you could have yoladetecha, the woman who gives birth to you. So thank God we actually have a very strong, close relationship with our surrogate, who is not from, but is a wonderful person, who we have no words to express our thanks to. And if you want afterwards, I'll show you a picture of Simcha and Rina, who are doing great. And please God, what I hope is that our story will encourage other people not to give up hope either. And there are halachic and medical solutions. It may not happen as quickly as you'd like, but if you keep on having emunah in yourselves and in God, you can have all your tefillot answered. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Levitt, for those beautiful words. I almost would like to end the session now. But let me make a couple of points. Very different than what I planned to focus on. I'm going to drop the formal presentation. I want to make three global points. First, let me talk about a few words about what we just saw. What we just saw is, first of all, a beautiful illustration of how every situation is unique. And every situation, the path to nechama, the path to comfort, is unique. And one size doesn't fit all. One way of coping that's right for one person isn't right for another person. So those of us who are providers of support and comfort, hopefully to couples going through this, have to understand that there's so many different pathways. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit. But first, let me talk about a colleague, Bessel van der Kolk, who's one of the world's leading experts on trauma. And he heard that a friend of his, a psychiatrist on 9/11 who was stuck in the World Trade Center and then barely escaped with his life, was having post-traumatic symptoms. And he reached out to him to help him, but he had a hidden agenda in that he wanted to, while he was treating him, see what a person's brain looks like when they're going through this traumatic event in their life. So he took pictures of his brain using an fMRI as he was having flashbacks to that horrible Tuesday 6 years ago. And he found that Broca's area was shut down, meaning the language centers of the brain were shut down, that literally he was rendered speechless as he was reliving those horrible moments. But then, perhaps more importantly, what Dr. van der Kolk's work shows is that where the cure, in quotes, comes from, it's from relighting up Broca's area. That as you give words to the pain, and as you name the monster, that's where healing takes place. And that's what we just saw. We just saw a wonderful illustration of how talking, how a husband and wife talking to each other and staying connected and helping others has that process go on. The research on infertility is in a way fascinating when you look at some of the pathways to healing. And there's an article that came out just a couple of months ago that showed that actually those who deal with it and cope with it by helping others going through the same thing, including a husband helping a wife and a wife helping a husband, that has a unique kind of power, especially in dealing with the ongoing trauma of infertility. So I guess the first message, and I'm not going to be able to say anything that wasn't said more beautifully and more poignantly by Rabbi Levitt, but the first message is just sort of the importance of lighting up Broca's area. In keeping with his name, he spoke about Vayido Maron. And there's a beautiful lesson in a Barbanel on Vayido Maron. The Barbanel asks, why does the Torah use that strange lashon of Demimus for talking about Aaron's pain? And he says, because one would expect that the word would have been sheket, vayishkod Aaron. Why Demimus? He said, because sheket, silence, is for when you know the answer and you choose not to say it. You censor yourself. Demimus is for when you yourself have no idea what to say, when you're literally rendered speechless. And that's what happens. That's what this does to families. That's what this does to couples. But the healing comes, and the process of healing comes gradually through reaching out to others to help others, others reaching out to you in the right way. And that's what takes you from the demimus position to the position of lighting up Broca's area, to the position of finding meaning. One of the things I found so interesting is how unhelpful it was when people tried to give you words of nichumen. And that's something that we know. We know from Divrei Chazal how careful we have to be about letting people find their own way. Being in this neighborhood, it comes easily to say over this Dvar Torah, and it's that Rav Schwab would talk about the word nechama meaning not comfort. The word nechama does not mean comfort. If you go through the Torah, the word nechama means a shift in perspective, right? First time it says the word nechama in the Torah is Hashem says, ki nichamti ki asisim, Hashem reconsidering making man, pen yinochem ham v'shavu mitzrayim, etc., etc. Go right through Tanakh. You'll see nechama is a shift in perspective. But the key, as caregivers, those of you who are trying to be there to support couples going through this, or those of you trying to support a spouse going through this, is that that shift in perspective, which is at the heart of real nechama, has to come from inside the person. All we can do is be there for them, and by being there for them, somehow help them find their own way into what's their toolbox of coping mechanisms that's going to give them that shift in perspective. I could tell over many, many stories of where Nechama came from. We just heard one story. But ultimately, the reason why what you found so helpful was particularly giving you Nechama was because it comes from inside you. It came from inside your heart. It came from the interaction that you had with your wife. And I think that that's a very important lesson for all of us to hold on to. Okay, so the first set of points has to do with, I guess, the importance of being there, but being there in a way that's receptive to one of the most difficult things in the world to do, which is to keep our mouth shut while just being there and letting them, giving them a voice. It's very, very hard. I have a hard time with it. Those of you who are therapists or about to be therapists, I'm sure, can empathize with how difficult it is. But again, those of you going through this, or those of you who are physicians offering care, the key is to try to just be there and give them a voice. That's what makes all the difference in the world. That was number one. Number two is the whole concept that this kind of difficulty, all the research shows, especially on the Orthodox community. There was some very nice work done by Dr. Dasi Billet, Billet Jacobson, who did her doctoral dissertation in clinical psychology on on infertility in Orthodox Jewish families and comparing them to Christian families, etc. And she found that uniquely in our world, what this does, this problem, is it pulls to isolation for all the reasons we're hearing about. We have such a family-centric world. Just think about the Seder and how child-centric it is. Just think about how much socializing in the typical Orthodox Jewish community is around children and grandchildren, and how painful that is, because it goes to the core of what's number one on most families' mattering mat. It's having children, raising children, and the self-concept, particularly of women, is inextricably intertwined in parenthood. And that's particularly difficult. And most people are well-meaning. But the reason this pulls towards isolation is that people almost always just don't get it. It's hard for people to get out of themselves. The dumb statement said to the Levitts are echoed hundreds of times in what I've heard in the course of my practice, where people are well-meaning, but they'll say, oh, you're so lucky you don't have to have those late-night feedings and you know what it's like to have a good night's sleep. Or, just sort of, or well-meaning advice about just adopt a child and you'll be pregnant in no time at all, or all those kind of statements. I mean, I had a patient who lost her husband in the World Trade Center, and she said she wanted to write a book called Shiva for Dummies, because she was keeping a list of all the particularly dumb things that people said when she was sitting Shiva for her husband. And that's what I find in general, that part of the strength of our community, which is incredible social support, and people are really there, somehow we don't know how to be there in the right kind of way with people who are struggling. And one of the ways to do it is just name the monster. Talk about it. Ask them. Say, I'm so sorry about what happened. First of all, just asking how are you doing is enormously helpful. But also asking, is there any way I can help? Just sort of opening up the avenue for them to be able to do what they want to do. Conversely, those of you in this room who are going through this problem and going through this whole process of the multiple stresses of various kinds of infertility, be it primary or secondary, have to understand that sometimes if you could figure out a way to reach out to others to tell them what you need, the average person is going to be very grateful. It's very hard to do that. But you know what? People are grateful. So if you tell them, something, what I really find helpful is A, B, or C. Or, I don't necessarily want to have this particular kibbutz at a bris of your child, but maybe it would be helpful if this happened or that happened. When people are taught to do that, to learn how to be assertive and ask for what they need, it can make an enormous difference. It seems simplistic, but there's all kinds of research on people going through different kinds of tough times that show, in fact, that it could make an enormous difference. So that's the second set of recommendations, is to learn how to reconnect by learning, on the one hand, how to ask for what you need, and on the other hand, for us as those offering help, to learn how to ask. And maybe there needs to be a gatekeeper. Maybe you need to get a close friend who really gets it to be the point person who's going to reach out to members of the neighborhood to tell the people in the neighborhood how to be supportive. Those are some of the things that people, when they're going through this, are too overwhelmed to necessarily be able to do that. But if there's one area, we had a focus group after 9/11 for members of the community, of our community, who experienced direct loss. And the number one request that people made was, we need help with the people in the community. They either drown us in their chicken soup, or they cross the street when they see us going by because they don't know how to talk to us. And that's universal, I think, for any kind of tough time. So learning how to navigate that is so important, because the refuah partly comes, I know refuah is the right word, but the support, the proper kind of support, especially in our community, comes from the proper kind of social support. If we could learn how to harness that, we have it, it could really make an enormous difference. So that's a second set of recommendations. And related to that, is the gender difference. Rabbi Levitt alluded to it. Let me just quickly share with you a study that some of you have heard me talk about. It's John Mordechai Gottman, who's the leading marital therapy researcher in this country, had couples fight when they were hooked up to biofeedback equipment. And he found that women, the more they talked about what they were upset about with their husbands, the more their blood pressure went down, the more their pulse rate went down, the more chilled out they became. Men, the more they talked about what they were upset about, the more their blood pressure went up, the more their pulse rate went up, and the more upset they became, and the men would stay upset for hours afterwards. So the refuah for the woman was the source of the machlah for the man. Interestingly, in the research on infertility and marital support, they find exactly that on the whole, the most effective coping on the part of women, and also the best way a husband could help the average woman, there are exceptions to this, of course, is to just allow her to talk, to be a sympathetic ear and an open heart. And conversely, men are most helped when they could give instrumental support, when they're problem solvers. Men are problem solvers. And when they're helped to do that, the couple is able to work together better. So a recognition that it's not better or worse, it's different. This is what men do for a living, this is what women do for a living, makes an enormous difference. So that's another thing to keep in mind in terms of the research. And finally, we talked about, and with this I'll end, there's the issue of one size doesn't fit all with coping, but ultimately the nechama comes from finding your own personal sense of meaning. It's often from helping others. It's often from helping yourselves. But also, even after a happy outcome, the research shows after a happy outcome, as we just heard, which had everybody so happy hearing the wonderful news of the recent double mazel tov to the Levitts. There's a beautiful insight that I'd like to end with, because I think it captures a very important point. Rav Yerucham Levavitz has a beautiful, beautiful insight into a very complex psychological process. It says in the Torah that God's footstool on his throne is Kamasa Livnesa Saper. It was a sapphire footstool built around the brick that was symbolic of the Sheba and Mitzrayim. So Rav Yerucham, who had incredible psychological insight, asked, Ma inyan shibud la'achar hagula? Why is it that after Yetzias Mitzrayim, God still has this part of his throne, the reminder of the pain and suffering of Sheba and Mitzrayim? And he answers, because it's to teach us for all time that after we go through tough times, the research shows, after there's a successful outcome to infertility, people go back to baseline. Very quickly they go back to baseline. And all the psychological stuff and all the psychological suffering gives way to being just a normal person. Though I don't know how normal anybody is. I just have a professor would say that there are two kinds of people. He'd say there are normal people and there are people I know. So, but there's some. You look like a normal guy to me, okay? But what Rabbi Yerucham said was it's to teach us for all time that even after things are better, you need to hold on to the brick. You need the askara. He says the brick is to teach us an askara, a memorial for all time, that even after we go through tough times and even after we have happy outcomes, we have to hold on the lesson of the brick alongside the light of the sapphire. The light in the brick. We need to hold on to that. My wish to all of us is that we experience the light, that you all experience the light, but that we also experience the incredible wisdom that comes from the brick and the incredible lessons that come from the brick, and that we should all be zoche to be able to be there in the right kind of way for people going through this, and that those people going through this should be able to be there for each other. And I want to commend the conference organizers for doing an incredible job of bringing together this kind of program. Thank you. I'm happy to say, but I think there's a problem that we have to end on time, right? Well, but we're happy to say, huh? We have 5 minutes, so let's have some discussion. I'm sure there are no comments whatsoever for either of us, right? It's beautiful, beautiful. Thank you.
So how do you put together knowing that Hashem is listening, but the answer is ultimately no, with always having hope and always davening that it's going to happen? Like, isn't it an important part of the healing process to say, okay, Hashem said no, and it's going to be no, and I'm going to find another way of finding meaning?
That's a great question. In other words, on the one hand, you don't want to give up. On the other hand, if the answer is no, sometimes the answer is no. I'll tell you, we learned from Moshe Rabbeinu, from that exact story, that you have to do both. In other words, you have to never give up. Moshe Rabbeinu kept asking. And that's our job. Hashem does his job, and we do our job. Our job is to keep on doing whatever we can medically, whatever we can, you know, spiritually, to please God, have what we want come true. But at the end of the day, we have to kind of feel deep down at the heart of our neshama that whatever Hashem does is what's for best. I may think that this is best, or I may not understand why that has to happen, but you know, you don't understand until years later, or sometimes maybe not even in this world, why things have to happen. At the very least, we can understand, my wife and I, that having gone through all this helps us be much more sensitive to other people and helps us appreciate much more what we have. And at the very least, we take that out of it. Maybe there are deeper reasons why this had to happen as well. But I think that while you're going through it, you do both. You never give up. At the same time, you somehow tell yourself that there's got to be a reason, and Hashem knows what it is, even if I don't.
I wanted to ask how you reflect on everything now from your new vantage point, and how much of the difficulty and the pain that you went through is still kind of borne by you and your wife, and how much do you feel that it dissipated and that you're not really bearing it anymore?
I'm glad you asked that, because I was thinking, listening to Dr. Pelkovitz, that's the one thing I really didn't comment. Not a day goes by that we don't think about these three children. Daven for them every single day. On the way here today, I went to the cemetery. They're very much a part of our lives. We believe that we have, people ask us how many children you have, and we tell them three now, thank God. But really, our answer is six. And we do believe that we'll be reunited with those children, please God, in the future. The pain is very much still there. I mean, thank God we have lots of joy, but this is only the last 4 months. A lot of what I spoke about today came from actually a shiur that I had developed based on our experiences a couple of years ago already, and started to come up with some of these feelings and reflections even before, thank God, there was a happy ending. So you're right. And Dr. Pelkovitz also made this comment that thank God now it's a little bit easier perhaps to go through this because we've had our tefillot answered, but not for a second do we forget these three children. And also it helps us appreciate so much more, you know, what we have. One other comment that I also forgot to mention is that our daughter, our first daughter, is named Shira Nechama. We named her Nechama at the time because each one of our families had a friend, a close family friend who had died of cancer. We didn't realize at the time that she would have been such a tremendous Nechama, such a tremendous comfort to us as well. You know, just looking back, perhaps our experience was all that much easier because thank God we had her. But to answer your question, I don't think the pain ever goes away.
You mentioned your daughter was five, or she's a little older now?
Well, now she's eight.
Now she's eight. So as she becomes and grows up, how might you explain to her, or I guess on a more emotional level, discuss with her what happened when she was five or younger, too?
We're very open with our daughter. First of all, obviously she had lots of questions about surrogacy, you know. We're having babies, but you're not pregnant, mommy? You know, like, a little confusing. And she's a very intelligent kid, and we're very open with her. In other words, we don't necessarily initiate all the time with her. We respond to her questions, but she's aware that we've had three pregnancy losses. She's aware there's three babies who are buried in New Jersey. She's aware that her two siblings, Simcha and Rina, were in Linda's tummy, but they're still from our genetics. She understands that, and we're very open with her. I'm sure, but I imagine that when she gets older, she'll probably have to talk that out a little bit deeper, and we'll figure that one out when we get there, I guess.
The research actually shows a very common question asked at high lifeline bereavement events is, do we tell new children born years after the death of an oldest child, do we tell our children, why should we have to let them know that there ever was an older brother or other sister? Why have them raised with that kind of sadness? And what the research clearly shows, and what experience clearly shows, is that openness and truth is better. Kids always know anyway. It's always there, even if it's not expressed with words. And that they do better with that openness, and they incorporate it almost always in a way that enhances resiliency and that gives their life even a little bit more depth than it might have had otherwise. So, like you're saying, honesty, openness, and then recognizing she'll have to rework it. All the kids, the twins, God willing, also the babies will rework it as time goes on. It'll be part of the narrative of their lives. You know?
Absolutely. At the Brit Milah, rather than giving like your typical speech, obviously I couldn't after all this, so I wrote a speech called An Open Letter to My Holy Twins, and I kind of read a letter to them in front of everyone. And it's a letter that I plan on giving to them. I'm not sure when, but I want them to know, the twins, I want them to know, you know, how much they're loved and how appreciated they are based on our past history. That someday we'll tell them as well.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories and your intelligence for both speakers. I had a question. My sister went through something very similar, and it was last year, and I was very, like, I didn't know how to approach it or to do anything. And I said sorry, but I didn't know what else to do. You give a hug, and I thought that was the most appropriate thing. I have other relatives who went through this, but I used to be that evil guy who didn't approach it and cross the street because I didn't want to encounter it. I didn't know what to say. But now, a year later, or 2 years later, do you think it's appropriate to approach now or just drop it and never bring it up again? And also another question. I think I heard it would be appropriate to ask how are you doing and what would you like or what would you need once somebody is in a Sheva house or something like that. But asking somebody who went through something so devastating, won't you think like a question of how are you is an appropriate question? I feel like we know the answer. They're obviously going through a very tough time. Why ask how are you? Is it something that should be addressed? Or how would you approach it in a proper fashion?
Well, I'll just make two comments. One is that, like I said, the pain's never going to go away. Even, please guide your sisters, prayers will be answered. She's always going to remember this. Many couples, especially around the anniversary of the time when they had their loss, will feel it even more, and other people will have long forgotten, you know. So every August and every March and every May, we re-experience our three losses, and some of our close friends and family may realize it, and most of our friends are clueless about it, but it might be very appropriate. Certainly around the anniversary, but even any time, just go over to your sister and say, I just want you to know, like, maybe some of your friends forgot, but I haven't forgotten, and I know how hard this has been. I know there's nothing I can do or say, but just know that I care, that I understand, you know. To me, that would, like, make all the difference, just to know that somebody out there is thinking of me and knowing how hard it is for me, and if there's something I can do, they'll tell me, but just to know that someone out there cares, I think that would make such a powerful impact on your sister. One other comment is, and like again, I can't really speak to the idea of primary infertility. We have many friends who are trying desperately to get pregnant. They've never been able to get pregnant. And there, it's like a similar question. Do you ask them, how did the latest IVF cycle go? You know, you want to show that you care, because if you don't ask, then it's like, okay, good luck, you're not in my mind. But on the other hand, you don't want to mutcher them and ask them all the time, did it work this month, is it happening? Because then they're just like reminding them. It's a difficult balance.
we try, I don't know if we do a good job, we try to say like exactly that. We say, the more explicit you are in my experience, the better. Like, I just want you to know, like, I don't want to bring it up, or you don't have to talk about it if you're not comfortable, but it's on my mind because I care about you so much. And if you ever want to talk about it, we're always wondering how things are going and we're davening for you. And if you ever want to talk, like in a second, I'm there. I just don't want to bring it up to you if you're uncomfortable.